Hello everyone and welcome to the first ever episode of the Laboratory Maniacs podcast. Joining me today is Cameron, and let me ask you a question.
Go for it.
How did you get into competitive EDH?
Some of my friends were starting to play and we wanted to take a look at it. It had an appeal because it had a known power level. We had a bunch of different decks at different levels, and every once in a while we'd have like one person that would just win on turn three or four, and that was the way their deck was created, and everybody else really wasn't set up for that. So we tried to get everybody on the same page for the power level of the decks and then started playing around from there. I was a crazy guy and decided to build control, and I thought about turn 12 was a good one to win on. And so that's where Tasker came from. And from there, I've branched out a little bit. I still really haven't gone into big combo decks. I've really been on control and stacksy decks for now. But how did you, Siggy?
Oh, that's a long story. So it basically all started when I joined a Skype group for EDH. I had not played the format at all before, but I thought, yeah, it looks kind of interesting. And in that Skype group was a person we all know, namely Jerry, who at the time was playing Derevi already.
That's a hard intro.
Yeah, so I was kind of tossed right into that and thought to myself, you know what? I'm not going to give up. I'm going to try to beat that. And yeah, that's basically what I did. So unfortunately, I didn't have much of a casual EDH phase, maybe like 3 or 4 months before I really started getting into competitive.
No, I had about 9 years. I started Magic in 2007. And it was basically just kitchen table Magic. It was right as Lorwyn came out. Actually, the first game I played, somebody was playing pre-release cards from Lorwyn. And I was like, Oblivion Ring, that card is so OP. Where can I get one? And it's not being released for another month. This was back when pre-releases were a month before the actual card, with the actual release.
Nice.
It was like, no, I'm going to lose to this thing for the next month before I can actually do anything. And then same guy introduced me to EDH, and I built a really terrible Scion of the Year dragon. It was literally just beat down with dragons. And I learned a lot from that. I had entirely basics in the deck. I had no way to mana fix. It was terrible. But I learned.
You did mention a really good point earlier, namely that before you really got into competitive, the power levels of your playgroup's decks were not really the same in a way. They were quite different.
Yeah, I had to deal with that myself. I used to carry 16 EDH decks on me.
Oh, Jesus.
All at varying power levels. So, I mean, I had probably two or three at more just like beat down, and then four or five that were very mid-rangey, but pretty well-tuned. So, I mean, they worked really well. They were very consistent in what they did, but they had slower plans. And then I had, seven or eight Battlecruiser decks that were everywhere from mono white to five color Progenitus Planeswalkers.
But yeah, I think one of the big issues that comes with the, let's say, apparent or supposed divide between casual and competitive EDH is that in many playgroups or at many stores, people play at really different levels. And these sort of different levels can create the impression that the type of EDH one person is playing is just strictly worse than the type of EDH another person is playing.
Yes. Yeah, and unless you have a really large population unless you have a large play group at the store for Commander, you don't really get the opportunity to branch out and kind of pod up with people at similar play levels. In Seattle, we have Card Kingdom, and you'll get 20, 30 people there playing Commander on a Tuesday night.
Damn.
And you have the ability to say, hey, I'm trying to play a competitive deck, and we've got 4 or 5 people that'll play that level. And then you've got people that are just starting, and they're cracking open a pre-con right now, and that's their first game of EDH ever. So having that large population makes it easier to self-moderate your power levels. But if you don't have that, it's really difficult.
Yeah. And that, I think, is one of the big things that, for me personally at least, competitive EDH is all about, and one of the things that really drew me to it. If I try to play competitive EDH with other people who also try to play competitive EDH, then all the decks we play will be at pretty much the exact same power level.
Yes.
And that is one thing I like a lot, because like, we've all experienced it. If you have a really casual and a really competitive deck in one pod, then it's probably not going to be a particularly fun game. However, when all the decks are at the same power level, and it doesn't matter what kind of power level this is, as long as it's balanced between all the decks, people are probably going to have a great time, regardless of whether they're playing casual or competitive EDH.
Entirely so. And that's probably one of the biggest frustrations with playing with a new group, is just trying to find the power level. And competitive does set that bar right away. It says, I'm going to try to win, and everything's available at the table. We're just going to go for it. And you get really interesting games that way, where everybody is coming to do that, and you know everybody else is doing it too, so you have to prepare for it. And it becomes a much more balanced game, where everybody is trying to stop everybody else from winning while still trying to win themselves. And it adds a really nice dynamic to the game. Whereas if you don't have that, it's like one person ends turn 3 with 8 mana, and one person ends turn 3 with 3 mana. And you have vastly different levels of what you can do on turn 4, and how you can play the game from there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The dynamic of competitive EDH is really something you can't find in any other format.
Oh, it's entirely different than 1v1 competitive games. In 1v1, you kind of just have your resources, and you're trying to go against the other person as best as possible, and you know what you have. In multiplayer, it is much more of a, can I really hold off 3 people right now and win? Or do I bide my time and let everybody else waste some of their resources for a little bit, and then try? I mean, you and I, we played a game last week where we had a Protean Hulk deck. I was playing Tasigur. We had, you were on your Hulk deck, weren't you? No, you were on Teferi. And what was Al on?
Tazri, I think.
Yes, he was on Tazri. And so we have 2 super fast combo decks, Tazri and Protean Hulk. And we have Chainveil Teferi as a stacks control deck and Tasigur as a primary control deck. And we had so many different phases in the game that it was, all of us agreed, it was one of the funnest games we played in a really long time. And yet,
oh yeah,
only one person won at the end of it. But it was a very active game. Everybody did something on every turn that meaningfully impacted the game. It was great. I mean, I ended up winning, but it was really interesting how we went through the whole process.
Yeah, that game was great.
I mean, we had a Hulk that was hard cast at one point.
Oh, yeah.
We had a Tazri deck that tutored 5 times in one turn with through a Yogg-Will and didn't win. We had
I know, I saw like 40 cards in 5 turns in that game,
yeah,
and I
it
didn't win.
and there were points in the game where it was like you said, no, don't give Cameron the exploration and the burgeoning. He's going to win in 2 turns.
Yep.
It was through a Manifold Insight, and he did. I did end up getting those between the 2 other cards, and 3 turns later, I did end up pulling out a victory. But it's just kind of like that. You need to either stop me now, or someone needs to win now, or the decks with inevitability will come up, and we've passed the point where the combo decks are trying to go off. And we had the Protean Hulk deck hard cast a Lab Maniac and then Tainted Pact themselves, and almost they just needed a mana at the bottom of the table or at the bottom of the deck, and they would have been able to draw a card off of their Thrasios out in play. But they didn't. And it was just kind of like everybody was trying to go for a Hail Mary to finish out the game before it wasn't possible.
Yep, and nothing ended up working, unfortunately. But yeah, that's a great example of one of the things that make competitive EDH so great. Like that game had just so much, such a depth of like intricacy and so many different points where we could have done things differently, and who knows how it might have turned out if we had. And it's like it's the kind of thing that really sticks with you. And you get a lot of these games in competitive EDH where you like can think for the next week or two, okay, it's turn four. What if I had done the other thing?
Yeah, I actually had a question. I activated Tasigur and was given back to Pact of Negation. And I wanted to force Al to counter your spell. I think you were casting a Rings of Brighthearth. No, it was Tezzeret. You were trying to cast Tezzeret, and I had activated Tasigur and I was tapped out and I had a Pact of Negation. And I was like, well, you know what? Al, you haven't done anything for a while. I'm just going to pass priority to you. You countered, or the game's over. And he was like,
Yeah.
"Ah, you forced me." And he had a Force of Will in hand. He forced, you forced back. And then I had to Pact of Negation in order to actually stop the game from ending. And the order that I did that in, I was convinced that I did it wrong, and there was some way that I could have cast Pact and not have to pay on my upkeep for it, had it fizzle somehow. But then I walked it through, and
If you had packed it right away, then he wouldn't have forced, etc.
or he would have forced your force and let my Pact counter Tezzeret,
Yeah.
and then I still would have had to pay for it if the game didn't end. So if he played perfectly, I would have still had to cast Pact and had to pay for it. And it took me a little while to actually think through all of those processes and say, no, I did it the best I could, but I still thought I could have done it better.
Yeah, and that brings me to another, I think, really important point regarding what being competitive in a format such as EDH is all about. I think that, you know, we talked at length now about all of these like cool plays and possibilities we could have had, but it takes time and effort to get there in a lot of different ways. And
Oh, yeah.
at the heart of it, being competitive is a lot about simply wanting to improve.
For sure. There are levels of the hobby of playing Magic that you have to adjust through as you're becoming a player. One of the things I identified early on was that I did not like tournament Magic. I didn't like the format. I didn't like the pressure on it, but I still wanted to be a better player. So you learn how to play the game as best as you can while still not wanting to throw money at it. Right? For me, early on, it was budgetary. I didn't have the money to pay for four copies of a $30 card, so I bought one of those, and I played EDH.
Oh, yeah.
And I slowly but surely, I was lucky. Back when duels were 20 bucks, I slowly got all the old duels for Scion of the Year Dragon, and I made that mana base possible. But through play, you can find problems with your play style, your habits. I forget, I play way too fast. I know that, and I really have to slow myself down. There were times where I'd like cast something and then tack three other things on top of that, and then realize that, oh, I thought they had already passed priority and this was going through, and they hadn't, and everything I just did kind of crumbled to ash. But you learn that through playing and through figuring out how you can do it better. That and learning rules, that was huge for me.
Oh, yeah.
The difference between naming targets and when things happen on resolution, choosing versus targeting, naming a card. Those were nuances that took forever. Like, by the time Pithy Needle names a card, it's too late. By the time Iona names a card, it's too late. And you're like, well, okay, when does it do that? Oh, when it's coming into play. Oh, I have to counter it or I can't kill it.
Pretty much.
Well, okay, I don't really know what to do then. Looks like we're dealing with an Iona.
Yeah, getting better at rules is definitely also a big part of learning about the game, because what it lets you do is... this might sound a bit maybe scummy or not particularly nice to people, but precisely knowing the rules will help you be a better player, in the sense that you can see these tiny windows where you can generate advantages. For instance, it's even when it comes to stuff like when to cast things and this kind of stuff. If you know your rules and know when you can do stuff and how you can do it, you will automatically, of course, have advantages over other players that don't know that. One big thing that you already alluded to earlier in that regard is priority.
Yeah. Priority and passing it around, it's something that I thought I had a really great understanding of, and looking through the rules yet again, I mean, I'm 10 years into playing Magic and I found a new nuance that I was reading through and realized I'd been playing something partially incorrectly. It hadn't really overall mattered, but there would be corner cases where it could. So,
For instance, one thing that I found quite interesting during the CEDH subreddit tournament was one of the finals games where Neosloth had a Pact of Negation that was basically known by everyone. And one of the players went for some kind of winning line to basically force the pact from Neo, because he could have won on the next turn otherwise. Mm-hmm. However, I think it was both Imok and Stoxio Everywhere who were on Thrasios, and both had Thrasios on the field, came in priority after Neo. So what he could have done would have been to pass priority, not casting the pact, and force one of the two to spend four mana to activate Thrasios if they didn't have interaction themselves, to get another round of priority, which Neo then could have used to Pact of Negation the win from Leptis.
Gotcha. Yeah, working through that is interesting and yet a challenge. And sometimes it's kind of it's a gamble.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a calculated gamble. You've got a feeling when people have resources, and you can make it known. You can make the politics of it known that, hey, if this goes off, we lose the game. I don't have anything, or I'm not going to use this right now. I'm passing priority to you. You've got to deal with it. Even though they knew he had a pact, he passes priority, and if they don't do anything, game's over.
Yeah, this, I think, is actually one of the biggest differences between how politics work in casual EDH compared to how politics work in competitive EDH. One of the things that a lot of competitive players like to say about the format is that they're happy to not have to use politics at all, which I think is quite incorrect.
Yeah.
Because the main difference is basically that the form in which you do politics in competitive EDH is that you force people to do stuff. You're not saying, okay, I'm going to do this if you're going to do that later or something like that. You're saying, I need you to do this right now, which will, of course, give that person a disadvantage, or we are going to lose the game.
Yes, there's a very real do it now or game's over. And it's kind of everything that Tassiger does is, I don't have an answer. Hey, you're going to lose the game. Here's an answer in my graveyard. Give me this answer, please, now. Hey. And it's kind of interesting to choose your targets for Tassiger in that regard. If you hand it to somebody who's already passed priority, then it's like, well, here, you said you don't have anything. Give me an answer. And that definitely is kind of like a twisted arm behind their back. You got to do this now or the game's over.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely are using politics in that regard. Especially with stuff like Gitaxian Probe, where you can choose to keep the information secret. I mean, because you are looking. You're looking. But there's nothing preventing you from saying stuff. Or you could say, hey, I'm just going to tell everybody, so just reveal your hand. Technically, I mean, that's kind of a workaround, but once one person knows, it's not necessarily private information anymore. And so there's also the option of playing somebody's hand up if you didn't reveal it. And you're like, well, hey, dude, they're really scary. They're probably going to go off next turn. And then everybody's on edge looking at the person you just Gitaxian probed and not looking at you.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, for instance, if you like git probe the Doomsday player and you tell everyone, all right, well, he's got Doomsday in hand. He's obviously got the man on board. Let me play this stacks piece so he can't go off. That basically lets you hold three people in check when you wouldn't even have needed to hold that one person in check.
Yeah. And you can kind of guise it through, but it's all politics. That's all that is. And it's talking to the table and saying, hey, this might happen. Here's my answer.
Yeah.
And seeing how they go.
And going along with politics, competitive EDH is a really, really interactive format.
Yes. Every blue deck is probably running 5 to 8 counterspells, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Almost every white deck is going to run Swords to Plowshares. Not every black deck's going to be running Fatal Push.
But Toxic Deluge.
They will be running Toxic Deluge, yes. Red decks will probably be running Red Elemental Blast and Pyroblast.
And so on.
Yeah, so everybody is holding up instant speed interaction. So there's a very real chance that on every one of your turns, three other people could do something. So you have to really gauge when you do your stuff too. Not only interacting with other people, but when do you deploy a threat? And what's a threat that is deployable, but not counterable?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, I have the best time in the world when someone counterspells a Training Grounds. Because it's terrible in competitive EDH, except for in Tasigur.
Yeah.
Where it halves the amount of mana you have to pay to activate Tasigur. And it costs one and a blue. And if somebody counters that, this is the best day in the world because they're not countering something else that's more threatening. They're not countering the Sylvan Library next turn, or they're not counting the Mystic Remora next turn.
Yeah, Training Grounds has always been a bit of a tough one for me because I know that if it's going to stick for 5 or 6 turns, then I'm going to be in big trouble, but I can't use up a counter spell for that.
Yeah, so hiding things in, sort of say, plain sight where people can't answer them effectively is something that is very real and competitive as well.
Yeah, definitely. And with this one thing that's present in all of Magic, but even more so in competitive EDH than in other formats, is this sort of idea of inevitability, where even a seemingly innocuous card like Training Grounds or Sylvan Library, which of course we all know is a really strong card, but it's not something that says I win the game right now. This sort of creates a system of checks and balances, if you want to call it that. On one hand, you've got the decks that are going to try to threaten the win early that usually tend to fall off for quite a long time after that initial threat. And on the other hand, you have decks that often feel like they're spending most of their time trying to play catch-up, like slower stacks decks or your control deck, that then again abuse this apparent slowness of a fast combo deck past first win attempt to draw closer to this line of inevitability or an overwhelming advantage.
The timing on those inevitability engines can be kind of an interesting dynamic within the game. You're spending resources on a card that may or may not give you that inevitability down the road. And part of investing in those is also realizing when it's a good time to do it for the game versus when you need to hold back those long-term engines and keep up interaction. And that's kind of something you learn with playing in a combo deck or playing against a combo deck, is when they're likely to go off. How much mana do they have available? Can I pass the turn with 2 mana up, or do I need to pass the turn with 4 mana up so I can have 2 pieces of interaction? And once you get there and you're like, okay, I think I can actually go with this, and you can put down a Sylvan Library. And now you're actually putting more pressure on that combo player to end the game in the next 2 or 3 turns. If they don't, you're going to pay some life into that Sylvan Library and draw 4, 6 extra cards that you'll be able to prevent them from winning the game more efficiently and easier. It's an interesting dynamic of dealing with the inevitability versus the quick spike of I'm going to win the game right now.
Yeah. Two of the big things we touched on today are, or like went into for a tiny bit, were deck building for a competitive meta and just now threat assessment. These and some others are core skills when it comes to getting into competitive EDH. And after giving you all a short insight into what the format is like for us today, we are going to use future episodes to delve deeper into these specific topics.
Very much so. With deck building, the elephant in the room is budget. And we will touch on it further in future episodes. But for competitive Magic, it's entirely possible to play on a limited budget. And we do want to walk through, or we will walk through, ways that you can look at budget options on how to manage a deck on a $200 budget, a $500 budget, a $1,500 to $3,000 budget. And some of those numbers are very daunting. But it's a slow process. If you enjoy the game and you enjoy the hobby, you invest money into it and you do it over time. You can trade up. But having that initial giant dollar value doesn't necessarily mean you have to go for that deck or you have to go for that deck 100%. You can still get a competitive tuned deck at a much lower price point that it's easier to get into a competitive environment in. And yes, it's not going to be 100% tuned. You're not going to be able to fetch out an Underground Sea immediately on a $300 budget. But you're able to get into the games and able to get the mindset and the play style and all of that together. And we'll go over that more when we hit on the deck building.
Yes, and I think for that particular episode, we already have the perfect guest. I think we could bring on Dan, since he's been writing all of those budget CEDH articles on the subreddit that have been really well received. And yeah, we're definitely going to do that in the future, and there's much more to come. However, I think at this point we're done for today. I hope you enjoyed the first episode of the Laboratory Maniacs podcast. I am Siggy, with me was Cameron, and we'll be seeing you next time. We'll be right back.